You're listening to the home of cool, irreverent, and entertaining talk right here on LA Talk Radio. You're listening to Answers for the Family with Alan Cardoza and Dr. Melody Fox right here on LA Talk Radio.
And welcome to another edition of Answers for the Family. I am your co-host, Dr. Melody Fox, clinical psychologist, and my co-host, Alan Cardoza, who has Westfield Services, who goes and finds abducted children throughout the world. Unfortunately, he's not with us today, but fortunately, he is out on a case and making sure a child comes home safely. So he will be returning next week, as far as we know at this point. So you've got me today, and each week we do bring you guests that can inspire, educate, and entertain while bringing answers and options to raising children today and in our constantly changing future. Now, we will address issues such as locating your runaway teen, such as what Alan does, family crisis intervention, building self-esteem, dealing with addictions, and so much more. We like to have a lot of fun with it, too. And each of us have over 30 years' experience working with families in crisis, specializing with teenagers, especially for me. And we've both been fortunate enough to meet and work with some of the top professionals in this field who are all working to make this world a better place for all of us. And we can bring you some of these incredibly talented and caring people each week as we bring to you Answers for the Family. Now, today, we are going to be talking to the author of a wondrous book, This Won't Hurt a Bit and Other White Lies. It is written by Dr. Michelle Au. Great title, or great name, I should say. Dr. Michelle is wrote about her education in medicine and her foray into motherhood. She also graduated from Wesley College back in 1999, received her MD from Columbia University College of Physicians and Surgeons in 2003, and completed her residency in anesthesiology at the Columbia University Medical Center in Manhattan. Now, for the past decade, she since has since she was a second-year medical student, she's been writing online about her life in medicine as well as her life outside of medicine. And her blog, The Underwear Drawer, is one of the oldest and best-known medical blogs on the Internet. And I encourage everybody to go to that blog. It is a wonderful website, and you can find it at www.michelleau.com. So, Dr. Michelle, welcome to Answers for the Family before I just keep talking about you.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it, Melanie.
Well, it's a thrill to have you, and I have to say, I got your book a few weeks ago, and I've been trying to sit down and read it, and once I opened it up, I could not put it down. It was so much fun to read.
Oh, I'm so glad you liked it. I get that from a lot of people, but you never know if they're being polite or not. So I do appreciate it.
No, I'm not being polite at all. but I did really, really enjoy your book. I found it to, you know, I just found it very charming and fun. I would have been a doctor had I been able to stand the sight of blood. And you do get a little queasy here and there.
Yeah, there are always those moments in med school where you kind of see things that you kind of wish you could unsee, but I guess that's part of the job. You know, I mean, the thing with writing a book about medicine is that it's something that everyone is sort of interested in a lot of different ways. I mean, it's a very fascinating field, obviously. Mm-hmm. We do a lot of interesting things, and there's a lot of personal interest stories. But there's also a lot of sort of horror stories, and people, you know, feed off of different things in medical stories, which is why I guess there's so much interest in popular culture with TV and Grey's Anatomy and ER and all those kinds of things, though you would have to question if the interest in Grey's Anatomy is less medical and more soap opera-ish, less like real life.
Well, you know, I'm very thankful that they aren't more medically based on that particular show. Otherwise, it'd be hard to watch. I'm not into those ER show the guts and show the blood thing.
Where there's a cleaver in some guy's head. Yeah,
that's okay. That's all right.
But yeah, thankfully that's not too much based on reality that we see every day, though it does happen.
Well, I thought what was a lot of fun is once you get through the first page, you get a sense of your humor and what this book is going to be about when you're talking about, well, I don't know if I could say it on the air, but when you're digging around to get a sample. And it kind of takes you through your whole journey, and that's what was a lot of fun about the book, at least for me, and it was very interesting and gave a lot of insight. And I thought that, you know, Well, I wrote down a lot of different notes, and I'm trying to read my own writing here because I handwrote them, unfortunately. I have a doctor's writing as well.
Doctor's handwriting, exactly.
Yes, I do. But, you know, you wrote in there, well, I want to talk about that later, but there's so many things I wanted to ask you about. But being a doctor, what got you interested in being a doctor first? Do you come from a doctor's family? Was that kind of ingrained, or is this something out of the blue that you thought, oh, I like helping people and fixing people?
Well, I do come from a medical family. Both of my parents are physicians, and they trained in New York in the 70s. So I sort of grew up around it, even though to some degree I really didn't understand medicine even growing up with two physicians as parents. You know, a lot of times I think when you are a kid, you're aware of what your parents do in theory, but it's a little hard to understand in practice what they do every day. So I had this, you know, idea that my parents helped people, that they went to the hospital or they went to their office and saw people. But so far as I knew, all they do was, you know, putting Band-Aids on kids. You know, just as a child, I think it's difficult to understand the scope of any field, including medicine, or perhaps especially medicine, because it is a little bit complex to explain it. Growing up, my parents actually sort of actively tried to discourage me from going into medicine, and perhaps that's a little bit of a sad commentary on our times. You know, I hear a lot of physicians with kids sort of encouraging them to look around or look into other fields, and I think a lot of that is because to a lot of people, perhaps the idea of being a doctor is sort of a tough sell, because it's a profession, while it has tremendous rewards, both, you know, personally and, you know, as a career, you could rarely find anything more fascinating. There's a lot of headache and heartache associated with it, mm-hmm. especially nowadays with, you know, healthcare reform and all that sort of thing. There's a lot of medical legal aspects that people in the past didn't have to think of, decreasing compensation, all those sorts of things that make people who are sort of more senior in the field sort of either yearn for the olden days of medicine or encourage their kids to look at something else. Mm-hmm. So I did want to go into medicine. I continue to look around on my parents' encouragement, but it's just one of those things that you sort of naturally fall into. You know, I was good at science. I liked being with people, and I really found it very fulfilling every time I was involved with volunteer work in a medical setting. I thought, this is what I want to do. I can't imagine anything that could be better than this, mm-hmm. this feeling of being able to help people in this very practical way. So I guess despite my parents' admonitions, I did end up going to medical school anyway, and I'd like to think that they're proud of me at this point.
Well, I can't imagine they would not be. You're a very successful writer here, and as well as physician. Now, how old were you? You said you always wanted to be a doctor. How young were you when you first realized that's what I really want to do and got serious about it?
Yeah, you know, it's hard to remember. I mean, I think kids say a lot of things, so it's really hard to differentiate when you started saying you wanted to be a doctor from when you actually understood the scope of what you were saying. I mean, I think I probably started saying I wanted to be a doctor when I was 5 or 6. That said, you know, kids say a lot of stuff. You know,
sure.
I mean, kids say they want to be astronauts. Kids say they want to be firefighters. So it's hard to say how much I meant it. The fact that it did end up being what I'm doing today is perhaps a coincidence, but I do remember vividly, you know, when I was about 5 or 6, you know, when I started school, mm-hmm. about first grade, that I figured that's what I wanted to do. And guess that worked out.
Yeah, so were you very studious then, I would imagine, in high school and junior high school?
I was. I mean, you know, I grew up both, I'm Chinese, my parents are both Chinese, and came from Hong Kong for college. So, you know, say what you will about the, you know, quote, Chinese style of raising your kid, but, you know, education was always an emphasis, and certainly I think I worked hard. I probably didn't work as hard as I should have, but, you know, I like to think that I put education on the forefront. But I don't think I worked any harder than anyone else. I mean, I went to high school in New York at a very good school, and everyone else was working as hard, if not harder than me. You know, people who even, you know, had English as a second language or had many more obstacles to overcome certainly worked harder than I did. So I certainly towed the line, but I wasn't any more smart or worked any harder than any of my classmates, I don't think.
Mm-hmm. Now, in your book, you wrote a lot about, you know, the different people that you've met. I assume following all the HIPAA laws and all that about privacy that they are not the real names.
No, I changed a good number of things. And, you know, that's from the experience of writing online for about 10 years, you kind of learn how to do that, or at least you hope you've learned how to do that. You know, there's certain signifiers in HIPAA and for patient privacy that you cannot reveal because they're patient identifiers. So I always try to change at least a couple of things, be it the patient's gender, the time that it happened, perhaps the medical condition. You know, there's a lot of things that you can sort of fudge. But I also, we did also have two lawyers read through it very carefully to make sure that there's nothing further we should change before we put it into print.
Oh, sure. Yeah.
Exactly.
Well, I know I have a compilation of, I've seen so many clients. There's a Justin and not that everybody's the same. Everybody has different variables, of course, but there's certain aspects of the clients that you could talk in generalities because it's so universal. There's no way they could go, oh, that was Susie B that lives on 255 Fifth Street. You know, they could not identify that person even if they tried because there's so many different people that that could apply to.
Right. But you do definitely have to be careful because, you know, part of being a doctor or treating people is that there's this trust inherent in forming that relationship. So you would hate to think that in helping them, and even in helping them in sharing a story that could, you know, help or teach other people, that you're violating that trust in some way. So we really do sort of very, with a very critical eye, anytime I share a story about a patient in specific, as opposed to just a clinical picture, you know.
Are there any particular stories you could share with us right now?
Yeah, well, I have many of them. I have a whole full of them. You know, some of them are, you know, it's like anything in life. There's many stories that are funny, and there's some stories that are sad, and some stories that are both, you know, that they can be funny and sad at the same time. And that's just really very emblematic of the process of medical training as a whole, is that you're thrown into the situation where you're feeling a lot of intense emotions, and obviously it's literally life or death in front of you. For someone who really, you know, up until that point has been relatively sheltered. I mean, I think most people that are in medical school have gone through, you know, their due diligence of going to school and you go to college and get good grades and you go to medical school and you study. But this is the first time, you know, when you're in the clinical wards, you know, in medicine, that you're really experiencing life so viscerally and so extremely. I can think of one story in particular, which is the story that sort of opens up the book, which is as a third-year medical student on my surgery rotation, you know, I start off the story sort of in media res, where I'm doing actually a digital rectal exam on a patient. So it's one of those things that you are aware that medical students have to do, but not until you're actually doing it do you realize, like, wait, this is kind of gross. I can't believe that I, A, am allowed to do this, and B, that I am doing this. And later on in the night, as the night drags on, because as medical students you end up staying late a good deal of the time, that I'm in the surgical suite with some senior residents and my attending surgeon, and they're operating, and I'm feeling very useless because as a medical student, you really don't have, A, the training to help in a very meaningful way, and B, just pretty tired, like kind of wishing that I could go home. And in that moment of observing the surgery, I actually saw a small hole that someone at some point had nicked in the bowel, which a hole which could have basically catastrophic consequences if it wasn't spotted, and if they did end up closing the patient and this hole continued to leak, you know, the substances of the bowel out into the peritoneum or into the abdomen, that could, you know, basically hurt the patient very badly or kill them. So that was the first time, and I, you know, stopped the surgery. I told the surgeon, look, I see a hole. They didn't see it, so I sort of just made them stop and waited until the hole reappeared, and I pointed to it so that they could close it, and patient ended up leaving the OR and ended up doing well. So that was the first point that I felt like I actually helped someone, and even though it wasn't anything through my surgical skill or even through my medical skill, it just happened that I was standing there and it happened to be that I saw it.
Right, and I'm glad you shared that story, but you said it in a nutshell. I do want to say to anybody listening to please go get her book, This Won't Hurt a Bit, and Other White Lies. It's fun, and the story she just told, it's told much more colorful inside the book as well. Lot more details there, but that's why you need to go get the book, because I just think it's wonderful and it's a fun read and it's a lot different than the usual books I read, and I quite really enjoyed it. And you had so many good stories in theirs too. Now, what I really liked about that is that it really took you through the journey from when you first got to medical school, you know, wrapping up college and going into your first year residency and second and third. And I had no idea there were these different hierarchies of what first year, second year, third year, and fourth year meant.
Oh, absolutely. It's medical school and medical training is not unlike the Army in a lot of ways. And, you know, I say that having not been in the Army, but in terms of the hierarchy and how deeply ingrained the culture of that hierarchy is in the medical field is very similar to stories of, you know, our armed forces, like much like I've heard. you know, there's such a demarcation. I mean, we don't wear stripes on our sleeves like in the armed forces, but it's very easy to tell what level of training someone's in, even just by the type of white coat they wear, the type of equipment they're carrying around, how put together and clean they look, and how well rested or not well rested they look. It's pretty easy to spot from a distance even who is a first year medical student and who's a fourth year medical student versus who's a resident versus who's an attending. Very simple. Well,
you say that, but as a patient being in hospitals, I would find it very difficult. I know you wrote in the book at one point that, you know, people are calling you Dr. Au and you haven't even graduated yet.
Yes, I know. And I think that is an issue for patients. You know, in medical school, we were taught or trained that there's a way to greet people, and I still do this every day. You know, those things, those habits you learn early on, either in childhood or in your training, that stay with you, and you always say your name, and then you say what your role is. So at this point, I always say, my name is Dr. Au, I'm one of the anesthesiologists, or I say I'm one of the anesthesia doctors to make it sort of clear, because sometimes people don't understand what an anesthesiologist is. Mm-hmm. And at the time when I was a medical student, I would always introduce myself as, my name is Michelle Au. I'm one of the third-year medical students who's rotating on the service, and I work with Dr. so-and-so. So just to make it clear, because I don't think anyone aims to obfuscate what their role is in medicine, and I think often for patients it's very difficult to tell. You're correct. People who aren't used to looking at the nuance and saying, oh, he's wearing a short white coat instead of a long white coat, he is here at 3 a.m., not at, you know, 9 a.m. on rounds, he must be a trainee. So I think it's important to be upfront about it and for patients to have full knowledge of who's taking part in their care.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, and I do the same when I was an intern or a psych assistant or whatever. I'd be Dr. Melody Fox because I graduated, but I'm a psych assistant working under so-and-so and so-and-so and so-and-so. But I think people in crisis, I would imagine the same thing when you're talking to a patient who's breathing in pain in bed. They don't hear all that. They just want to know, are you going to help me?
Yeah, I think that's absolutely true, and I remember from being a patient, and I haven't been a patient too often, thankfully, but, you know, there were a couple times when I was in medical school, I had a ruptured appendix, and I was, you know, in the hospital for about 2 weeks total for that, and I remember not as much as as I probably should from the hospitalization, because when you're sick, it's, you know, your perception isn't quite as clear as when you're well, you know, the lucidity isn't quite on the same level. So I can very much understand from that point of view, and it was a good experience to have at that point in my training, the experience of being a patient and how confusing it is and how powerless you feel, even as a, you know, quote, trained medical professional, being in the hospital is the most powerless, basically, role you can assume.
Well, yeah, I heard doctors make the worst patients, too. Do you think
absolutely.
That's true?
I mean, luckily I was a medical student, so I was very used to sort of taking orders and just listening to and just doing whatever anyone said. I was very compliant, but even as someone who had a lot of medical background, to be in the situation where you're, you know, a lot of time you don't have a lot of information. You're sitting in a bed in a room. You don't know what's happening. You don't know what's going to happen next, you know. I mean, I had my friends, my other medical school colleagues sort of go out to the front desk and sort of ask, like, what's going on? What's going to happen? You know, just because as a patient, and I was lucky to have people around me who were able to do that, but as a patient, you really feel very powerless and very, you know, robbed of your ability to control the situation, because really you're not in control, and that's a hard thing to deal with, particularly if you're a doctor or a medical professional who's used to directing the care rather than receiving it.
Oh, sure, sure. Now, I was thinking about, You wrote in your book, later on in the book, that talking about pagers.
Yes.
And what a thrill it was to finally get your first pager.
Mm-hmm.
And being so excited whenever it went off. It's like, oh, I'm on call. Somebody called me. And then getting to a point where it's like, again, it's nonstop.
So, I know. It's one of those things where when you're a medical student, it makes you feel like you're part of the team, like having the accoutrement of being a doctor is part of becoming a doctor. So, you know, it's like you get your white coat and you're like, oh, it looks so good. I look like a real doctor now. You have your stethoscope. You figure out where to put it. You get your pager and you're like, this is what everyone else has. This is what my resident has. Mm-hmm. This is so exciting. You know, finally I'm being, you know, after all these years of basically just studying and being behind a desk and being with books, that you're in the environment and having the tools that you, you know, quote, need to do your job. And you realize very quickly with respect to the pager, what a pain in the butt it is to carry a pager, you know, that it's constantly ringing. It's just, it's like having a baby that just doesn't stop crying. It just is always needing something. It's hard not to personify your pager. I think a lot of people start to hate their pager and gladly get rid of it when they can.
Well, I know you discussed the perils of having a pager. Now, are you still on call using your pager?
I have a pager. You know, I'm an anesthesiologist. Most of the time when I'm on call, I'm in the hospital. And right now, you know, my pager sort of broke. I tried to get it fixed a couple of times, but, you know, we're at the point now where we all have cell phones. So I just tell people, just call my cell phone, because I don't care if I'll always pick up my cell phone. Like, I can tell if it's from work. I mean, there's caller ID. And sure. I just think it's just an extra step in reaching me in an emergency if I have to get paged and then I have to call back. I mean, what kind of delay is that, you know, for someone who is having an emergency to have to sit by the phone and wait for me to call back?
Oh,
I just
sure.
tell people, just call my cell phone. I have two cell phones, one's for backup, one's my primary, so I'm always reachable, and I just prefer just to cut to the chase.
Oh, yeah.
Call me
now,
anytime.
Now, you were talking a moment ago about how you're kind of a cocoon, you know, going through medical school all those years and all that until you get your long white coat to officially make you a doctor or have you feel like you're playing the role a little bit better. But during that time, I know for me, life went on hold when I went back to school and was working on my doctoral and everything and then all my postdoctorate stuff I had to do, internships, et cetera. So putting life on hold for most people as a doctor, is that normal or not normal? And what was your course? I kind of know because I read the book, but.
Right. I think it's pretty normal. I think that's pretty much the historical expectation of medicine, is that the process of training to be a doctor is so all-encompassing and so all-consuming and so 24/7 that it's difficult to expect someone to have any outside pursuits or outside interests, just because how would you have time to do that? And, you know, in the olden days, as I call them, and when I say olden days, I more mean like at the turn of the century when the medical education process was being formalized, that was the expectation. And that, in fact, you know, it's telling the names that we give the different ranks of doctors and residents, meaning postdoctorate, graduates of medical school who have not completed their training, were called residents because they lived at the hospital. They were residents of the hospital.
Oh, I never knew that.
So that sort of is illustrative of, you know, the expectation at the time. And even though it's 100 years after that point now, lots of the expectations are not so much different. So, I don't think it's that unusual to put your life on hold when you're training in medicine, because it's probably the simplest way to do it.
Now, according to your book, you met your future husband going through residency, or not residency, but when you started medical school. Is that true?
Yeah, I did, and that was great.
I'm
definitely glad that we met. I love you, honey. But it's good and bad to be married or involved with someone who's in medicine when you're in medicine too. I think the bad part, which probably is obvious, is that neither of you has very much time. You know, both of you are in this, like I said, all-consuming pursuit, and it's difficult to find time for each other. And, it's, you know, it's that times two, because you don't have anyone who's more flexible. You're just both equally inflexible about your schedule. But the good thing is that both of you understand why. You know, it's not like if I had what I refer to as like a civilian partner, that I'm always explaining why I have to be late, or like, oh, I said I would be home by this time, but actually this came up and I can't. And I would think that for someone who's on the outside of medicine, it might be a little difficult to understand why it is that I always have to put my job ahead of certain other things.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas for someone who's also in medicine, there's a shared culture and a shared language that makes some things easier. And I've never had to explain to my husband why it is that I had to stay late with my patient, because he understands that's your patient, that's your responsibility. And just as he would do the same for his patients, he understands when I have to do that for mine. So it's good in a lot of ways to have that commonality with your partner, like in many other, you know, areas. Probably that's inarguable regardless of if you're in medicine or not.
Right. And I read while you were looking for your fellowships, you were trying to be placed together.
Yes, that's probably comes up every year in every medical school class, that there's this process called the match, wherein the fourth-year medical students are matched to various residency programs around the country. But it's a little bit of a vague process, and it's not very precise always geographically. You can't say, I want to go here, I want this job, and apply for it and get it. It's much more of a sort of an algorithm than that. So you basically feed your choices into a computer, and the computer spits out where you're going to go, and it's not always where you thought you were going to be.
Mm-hmm.
So when you have two medical students trying to match, that there is a pretty large chance, unless you make some provisions, that the two of you could match in totally different states, and that's not ideal, obviously. So, yeah, so that's something we had to deal with, and we basically dealt with it by only applying to programs in one city, which is sort of a risky gambit, but it worked for us. We only applied in New York City, which is probably the one city that has that many hospitals that one could do that without running the risk of not having a job at all.
Oh, sure, sure. Now, during this time that you were doing your residency, and I know we're nearing September and 9/11, and you know that's coming up in a couple weeks, and you discussed your experience while hearing of this disaster, while being in the middle of a circumcision. Mm-hmm. And what was it like for you to relive that memory while you were writing the book?
Oh, yeah. That section was difficult to write. I would say that, after 9/11, everyone who was in New York at the time sort of went through a little bit of a metamorphosis, you know, well, in good ways and bad. New York really came together, and it was a very friendly place for a good period of time because everyone was really hit hard by the reality of what happened, and everyone was being really friendly and helping each other out. But it was hard to process it because it's just the scope of the disaster was so much more than anyone could have ever imagined. So I actually wrote the first draft of that section about a year after 9/11, because that's how long it took me to be able to write about it, because it's, you know, it's not something you necessarily want to relive, even if you weren't directly there. But and I worked on it a little bit, so it was probably a couple of years before the finished product took place. But it was an unusual experience, particularly working in a hospital at that time, because in some sense it's the right place to be during a disaster of that scale, because you really feel like you could be of use. Mm-hmm. And, we had so many people rushing to the blood bank to donate blood, and people just heading out to police precincts, seeing how they could help. So you're already situated in a place where you can help, so you feel useful. However, given, like I said, the scope of the disaster, there weren't that many people coming out of the rubble for us to be able to help. So in one sense, you feel, here I am, I'm perfectly primed to be useful and to be able to help people, which is why I came to medical school. Mm-hmm. And on the other hand, how useless you feel as a doctor, as a medical student, to not have people to help, it makes you feel even worse in some ways.
Right, and I know you wrote in there about how your particular hospital was so far away. Was it 100, 200 blocks or 100 blocks
right.
away?
Yeah, so the World Trade Center was down at the southern tip of the island, as many people know. And Columbia Presbyterian Hospital, which is where I was, is at the northern tip. It's up close to the Bronx, basically. Mm-hmm. So basically my hospital was the farthest possible point on the borough away from the World Trade Center. So, you know, first of all, there weren't that many patients that were coming out alive for us to help. Mm-hmm. And any patients that they were able to sort of rescue were going to closer hospitals just because of the state of the emergency. Obviously, you'd go to the closest possible hospital to get treated more quickly.
Sure.
So being so far away, despite the fact that we were one of the biggest hospitals, you know, in the city, that we were just empty and waiting. You know, we had emptied out all our ERs. We had emptied out all non-emergent cases to be able to receive the patients that we thought surely we would be able to see and help. You know, this giant hospital, so well equipped. Everyone was standing there by the ER base waiting for patients to come, and they never came, not that night anyway.
Yeah, and I know you followed up the writing stating that in the future to be more grateful for these small things, those assumed, you know, like my family's alive, no one has hurt them, you know. How have you been able to follow through with that idea and that concept of being more grateful for the small things?
Yeah, to be honest, I mean, I think all of us probably feel this way. It's easy to forget, you know, in the face of a large tragedy, you think, oh, I'm never going to take this for granted again. I will never take for granted the fact that I'm healthy, that my family is healthy, that we're all alive, that we're all able to be together. Mm-hmm. And, you know, in that moment, it's very easy to feel like that. And then, you know, time passes. Like you said, it's been 10 years. And you get wrapped up in the mundane details of your regular life. And it is easy to forget, honestly, how precious life is. And it certainly is worth reminding yourself, not necessarily in the context of necessarily remembering 9/11 every given day, but just the concept that that life is uncertain and it can be brief. So it's, working in a hospital, you would think that the juxtaposition of life and death every day in front of you would make you appreciate things more like that. Mm-hmm. But, you know, when it is every day that you see it, you do tend to tune it out. So it does take work to remind yourself, perhaps especially as a medical professional.
Well, I think that's, you know, you become a little bit more immune, but I think that's a survival mechanism. If you thought about everything that everybody goes through, the pain and the death and everything that you experience day in and day out, and of course all the life you save too. I think it's normal to kind of tune that out and kind of downplay that and become a little bit more numb to that.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. I mean, I think when I was in medical school, I cried a lot more, you know, because everything is so raw. You know, you're like a tiny little baby chicken, and you're mm-hmm. being thrown into this, machine where there's just intense emotions and people screaming at you and people dying and babies being born. And it's just so intense that it's hard when you're new at it to insulate yourself from all those feelings, whether they're your feelings or someone else's feelings.
Sure.
And then you realize that to be able to do your job, and probably you understand this especially, you know, as a psychiatric professional, that to be able to do your job, you do have to have a certain degree of remove mm-hmm. because you can't feel everything all the time because you just wouldn't be able to function. You wouldn't be able to cope, you know, working with life and death all the time, and just you can't be crying at work every day. So you just get used to it. And it's, you know, maybe it says something bad about ourselves that we're able to get used to it, but it also says something about adapting, you know, that you do have to adapt in some ways to what reality is. And I think I talk about that in my book a little bit more near the end, during the end of my residency, that I was intubating a patient who was terminally ill, and the patient's whole family was around, and they were crying because they all wanted to say hello to her before she was intubated, because after the breathing tube was in, she wouldn't be able to talk anymore. Mm-hmm. So they all came by, and we had them leave the room, and I was with another one of my my former med school classmates, who was actually a resident in the ICU at that time, and we were just doing our jobs. You know, we're like, oh, how's your baby? Good, good. How's your family? Good. And I'm giving the medication, the patient's going to sleep, and put the breathing tube in, and then afterwards, as I'm walking away, and I'm walking by the family, and I tell them everything went fine, that you think how strange it is that something so life-changing becomes commonplace. Mm-hmm. You know, to the point that you're having a coffee table conversation with your coworker over, you know, something like a terminally ill patient who's getting their breathing tube in probably for the last time.
Well, that also shows what a professional you are and what a great doctor you are, because you're able to do that almost automatically while distracting yourself from what you're doing as well in a healthy way.
Well, I don't know. I mean, I would hope that it is adaptive, but sometimes you feel that being too jaded, you know, I mean, you can see it in older doctors that, you know, you get jaded to a point and then you sort of start cracking. It's like, it's not good to have too thick of a shell, I think. You do have to be able to feel things sometimes.
Yeah.
So you try to walk that line, balance the two.
And part of the balance is, too, having a good sense of humor, which definitely comes out through your book. And we are talking to Dr. Michelle Au, the author of This Won't Hurt a Bit and Other White Lies, My Education in Medicine and Motherhood, here on Answers for the Family. We're going to take a quick break, and we'll be right back with more. Stand by.
Founded over 25 years ago to meet the needs of families in crisis, West Shields specializes in resolving adolescent issues that negatively impact the family. From preteen to young adult, we are experienced and qualified to help. We offer solutions which include referrals to a network of top professionals internationally that we work very closely with in the fields of educational consulting, psychology, and psychiatry. Our in-home crisis intervention care program helps to stabilize families and bring effective resolution. We are supported by our licensed investigation company that enables us to offer legal and expert services for locating runaway teens and more. Our therapeutic transportation services help to ensure that adolescents in crisis are safely provided transportation to specialized schools and programs with unmatched experience and success. Simply put, West Shield Adolescent Services is the best solution when your family is facing personal crisis. Call 1-800-899-8585 and let us help you.
And we're back to Answers for the Family. And today we are talking with Dr. Michelle Au, the medical doctor, anesthesiologist, who wrote a wonderful book called This Won't Hurt a Bit and Other White Lies, My Education in Medicine and Motherhood. And welcome back after our commercial break, Michelle.
Thank you.
And Dr. Michelle. And so we have some guest questions that people send to us prior to our show and sometimes during, and I have a couple. I'd like to pass them along to you and see what you think here.
Great.
The first one says, I have been married to a heart surgeon for the last 18 years, and we have a daughter, 14, and a son, 16 years of age. Although his profession was demanding, he always made time for them. Now, in their teens, I almost feel as if he's staying at the hospital longer hours so he will not have to deal with the teen drama and traumas. I understand that your children are much younger, But what is your observations of fellow colleagues with older children?
With older children, you know, I mean, I feel like what I've seen in the hospital, and granted, this is purely anecdotal because, like you noted, my kids are much younger, that parents that I've seen become much more invested in their kids when they become teenagers, and I don't know if it's just because they have so many more activities or maybe because there's so much more academically at stake for them, and obviously people who are in medicine do have some competitive drive when it comes to academics, that I hear them talk about their kids a lot more, particularly with respect to school. Mm-hmm. I'm hearing a lot more about, like, college visits and sporting events and things like that. And maybe just because when kids are teenagers, they start to develop a little bit more of their own interests and personalities. You know, my kids are age 6 and 2.5. So, you know, lots of kids who are that age do the same sorts of things. So, you know, everyone's stories are roughly the same. Mm-hmm. Whereas when you're a teenager, you know, some kids are very interested in one hobby or very interested in one profession, or they want to do volunteer work. It just seems like the doors start opening up to show you what those children are going to be like when they're adults. And mm-hmm. I find that people are talking a lot more about their kids and education and taking a lot more interest in their kids' lives.
Well, that's a good thing.
Yeah, it's excellent.
I'm glad to hear people are paying more attention to that. I think a lot of kids, I work with a lot of children whose parents are doctors, and they aren't home a lot. So they have nannies or they have other people watching them, and they wish their parents were around a little bit more. Now, your kids are young, and you were doing your fellowships. I know, well, somehow, some way, you talk about being able to talk on the street corner with your husband for about 5 minutes as you were going home and he was going to work.
Right. Yeah. It's one of those things. It's another adaptation that when we were residents, I was working the day shift for about a month that he was doing the night shift and I was doing the day shift. So we basically never saw each other because he was at work when I was home. Mm-hmm. So we just timed our paths so that they would cross at the subway station. So while he was going down into the subway station, I was sort of coming back home just so we could see each other and just at least exchange messages. This was before we had kids. I don't think that this would have been reasonable had we had kids at the time, but luckily it was early enough in our training that it was about a year before we had our first son. So I wouldn't recommend it. I think it places a lot of stress on both parties to have so much time strapped when you have an obligation towards a child. But people do it, and, you know, we had our child early in our residency, and it can be done. It's not the easiest thing in the world, but you just have to prioritize and triage, and then things that aren't important, you just kind of have to forget about.
Yeah, I was just thinking, I wonder how they had time to get pregnant, but, oh, well, they made the time. It only takes a minute, I guess.
That's a personal question.
But on that note, what was it like to be doing your rounds and all that being pregnant, and how long into your pregnancy did you end up working?
Oh, I worked up until the morning of giving birth, basically. I came into the hospital. Well, you know, I'll say first of all that I was very lucky that I had a very easy and complicated pregnancy. I didn't have anything like bed rest or any complications or even anything where I had to see the doctor more frequently than the usual prescribed, you know, intervals. Mm-hmm. So that made it simple. I was, you know, relatively young. I think I was, how old was I? Like 27 when I had my first kid. So that probably helps in terms of just being conditioned or I was used to being fatigued, I guess, as a medical resident. It's not much different to stay up all night with a baby than to stay up all night on call. So I was sort of
you were
acclimated to that that feeling. So it really wasn't that bad. And I think maybe I was trying, like many residents who are pregnant, I'm sure, do, to try to prove that I didn't need any extra time or that there weren't any concerns about me, because I didn't want people to think that I was weak or that I was asking for any special favors or allowances. I just wanted to prove to them I can do this. I can do this as well as anyone who's not pregnant. I can do this as well as the guy residents. It's fine. It doesn't matter. Mm-hmm. So, you know, you just, maybe part of it is me just trying, you know, my bravado and thinking it wasn't that bad. But I don't think it was. Mm-hmm. However, there is the sense of wanting to prove yourself and not wanting to seem to other people, because the fact of it is that no matter how easy your pregnancy is, you do need to take a certain amount of time off after you, you know, give birth. So I didn't want anyone to complain about it. So I want to show that I was the best possible worker that could possibly be up until the moment that I had the baby, and then I came back after 5 weeks. So
wow. Well, I'm glad you took the 5 weeks to recuperate and spend some time with your children.
Right. And that's 5 or 6 weeks is probably the standard residency maternity leave. Mm-hmm. But I did mention in my book that my mother, who had me during her second year of residency, and this was in the 70s, granted, she took 3 weeks off And I don't know if that was considered the, quote, standard then, because I don't think there was a standard, because first of all, that there weren't that many female residents at the time. And second of all, it was unheard of if there was a female resident for them to actually get pregnant during residency. It's just crazy talk. So hard to say if that was a standard or not. It just, that's what it was.
Oh, sure. And I was thinking, sitting here listening to you say that you're used to the fatigue and all that, what do you do to self-care? What do you do to nourish yourself so you can be more present and more awake and be there for your children and for your patients?
I think that's hard. I think that when I talk about things like triage and making priorities, your own self-care is definitely becomes a lower priority, whether that's healthy or not. You know, when you triage what you have to do in a 24-hour period, obviously your child and your job and your patients come first, you know, and even at a certain time, it's hard to even triage which one is more important. And I know that sounds terrible to say that your own child isn't necessarily the top, you know, rung on that ladder, but sometimes if you're at the hospital late and your patient really needs you, is sick, and that's your patient, that's your responsibility, you can't think, oh, but I got to go home because I got to give my kid a bath and give him dinner. Sometimes you have to, because it's your job, you have to put your patients first, and your kid will understand, and that's why you have a partner also to help you raise your kid. But between those things, those are two very all-consuming things, and I think that anyone who has kids or anyone who's worked in the hospital can understand it. After that, you know, you have a responsibility to eat and to sleep so that you can, you know, function.
Well, you talk
and there's
a lot...
very little time left over for self-care, so it becomes a real challenge. I think you're right in discussing that.
Well, I just keep thinking a couple different thoughts popped up while you're talking. One is, one of the things about staying at the hospital and working on your client is also explain to your children so they can learn empathy and compassion for the people who may be dying, and that if you're not there, they might die. So it's a life and death situation.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a good thing for kids to see. It's always important, and I cannot, again, overstate the importance of having a good involved partner in the childcare process, because it allows you to be able to make those decisions. Mm-hmm. You know, I don't know that I could make that decision, even if it was the right one, to stay with my patient if they're not doing well, and, you know, I can take care of my kid later, if I didn't know that I had someone who was able to go home and also take care of, you know, the baby. Mm-hmm. That it's it becomes a much more difficult decision when you don't have other choices. So I think having an involved partner and an involved other parent, whoever it may be, is crucial to allow you to see the situation for what it is and be able to make the right decisions and not just the necessary decisions. You know, you have to do what you have to do, and that's just a fact of being a parent. Uh-huh. So it's nice to have some backup.
Oh, absolutely. I know you wrote in your book something to the effect that, and it's something I like to teach my clients to do also, is that sometimes you just have to do it. And you wrote, you just do it. You can't think about how much there is to do or how much is going on or how tired you are. Is that kind of a motto that you live by?
I think that's sort of everyone's motto in medicine. I mean, I think that if you spent a lot of time overanalyzing the situation, or, you know, and I sometimes do see this, that people are lamenting so much how difficult the situation is that, you know, that it sort of takes away from dealing with it, you know. Mm-hmm. I mean, not everything in life is easy, and certainly there are a few things in medicine that are terribly straightforward, but you could just spend all your time lamenting how unstraightforward it is, or you could just do it and take care of business, and it's not going to be perfect, but at least you're taking care of what needs to be done. And I think that that's probably true of parenting and of medicine. There's a lot of parallels, actually, I would say, between being a first-time parent and learning to be a doctor. The coping mechanisms are similar.
Oh, that's a very good point, too. Now, I have another listener question here for you. It says, I'm a pharmacist who is becoming less comfortable every day with the amount of drugs I see being prescribed for children and teens, from obesity to depression to allergies and other conditions. As a mother myself, I am feeling that doctors have little knowledge of alternative recommendations such as diet and natural options, and just more convenient for them to grab a pad and prescribe a drug. Can you share this opinion, your opinion on this?
I think that's absolutely true. You know, and I think that a lot of what happens in that setting where you feel like doctors are less comfortable with you know, homeopathic remedies or alternative or complementary medicine is because we're not taught it, at least not when I went to medical school. And I graduated from medical school in 2003. Mm-hmm. So it was, you know, a while ago, but it wasn't that long ago. It was still, you know, year 2000, you know, relatively recent, and even at that point we didn't really have an intensive curriculum of alternate methods of treating things or natural methods. It was maybe like one day or there's one handout about it. So I think you're right in realizing that doctors are just not taught how to do anything besides rely on pharmacology or possibly, you know, it's perceived as an easy fix because of, you know, there's so many things you could argue that the drug companies market it in such a way, and so much of the marketing is towards doctors mm-hmm. that it makes it seem like, oh, you could read all about these natural methods or do, you know, behavioral therapy or this or that, or you could just write for Paxil, you know, that it seems easier and it seems like it's more within our wheelhouse of things that we're comfortable doing and that are easy to do.
Mm-hmm.
So I know that a lot of schools are starting to adopt curricula to teach about alternate methods, and I think this needs to become a little bit more widespread.
Sure.
But it's difficult because, you know, with medical advances, there's just so much more to teach in medical school now than there was even, you know, 20, 30, 40 years ago, and yet medical school is still the same length. So how do you pick and choose what you're teaching, and how do you prioritize at this point what's more important and what you sort of leave off? You know,
right.
We still spend 9 months of the year learning about anatomy, which is the same as at the turn of the century, but at that time, medicine was just what you could see with your naked eye, which is why anatomy was basically the bread and butter of medical school.
Mm-hmm.
And now there's so much more. There's genetics, there's pharmacology, there's, you know, molecular biology, there's everything. The world of medicine has exploded.
Oh,
so we really
absolutely.
Need to sort of pick and choose what we're teaching our students in the time that we have with them.
Well, and speaking about time, we only have a few more minutes, and I definitely want to get to this. What is a skunk monkey?
Scut monkey is a slang term that's used in medicine. So far as I know, it's mainly used in medicine, though I've heard it in other contexts. That basically refers to someone who's doing the grunt, menial tasks that other people don't really want to do.
Mm-hmm.
And there's analogies in other fields, like like a PA, a production assistant in, you know, on a movie set, is doing a lot of those kinds of things, that people don't want to do, and they just ask a very junior person to just do for them. Things like the rectal exam, things like running lab tests to the actual laboratory, entering computer results, you know, calling people on the phone. And that's just a phase that everyone has to go through. It's one of those trial by fire things that all medical students have to go through. Everyone's been a scut monkey. No one seeks to be a scut monkey forever, but everyone has to go through it.
Well, the acronym one of your residents passed on to you that you wrote was subcerebral use of time.
Yeah, and I think that's very accurate. You know, it doesn't take any skill to be a scut monkey, and I think it doesn't even, you know, most of the things that you do as a scut monkey aren't even necessarily medical in nature, that you don't have to go to medical school to do them. It's just you're there, you're free, you're always available, and you're never going to say no. And that's basically the main criteria.
Sure. Now, on that note, you have a blog, The Underwear Drawer, and
yes,
you have the scut monkey comics. Do you write and draw them all, too? Because it's a great doodle. It's
yeah, I do draw them all. I probably have about, you know, a dozen or so up on the website. And they're all free. Everyone can look at them. And they take a good deal of time to do. That's probably why I've done a little bit less as the years have gone on, because I have kids now, and it's a little hard to keep them out of my way as I'm doing this, because it does take a good couple of hours for each panel.
Sure.
But it's fun. You know, I used to do cartooning in college, and it's something I enjoy, and it's something that people really respond to, perhaps even more than the writing, honestly, because it's just that kind of thing where people like to email it around.
Mm-hmm.
So it's just basically cartoons about medical training and what it's like to be a resident in a humorous vein. And people seem to really enjoy it.
And what got you interested in writing the blog in the first place?
Just when I was a medical student, I felt like I had no creative outlets at all anymore. You know, when I was in college, I did cartooning, like I mentioned. I had a humor column that I wrote in the school paper, and I did a lot of writing and just creative stuff on the side. And then when I was in medical school, like we mentioned before, it's so all-consuming that you just have nothing else. You're just doing medical school and being a med student, and that's it.
Mm-hmm.
And I just felt so, like, depleted from that I just didn't have anything else in my life that was creative. So I just figured this was a low impact way, didn't require any commitment, it was free, you know, and it was a way to write publicly so that people could read it, but that, you know, that I didn't feel like I had to write every day or every week.
Did you feel like you had to write when you were writing your book?
I did, because there was a schedule and a contract, so I did sort of feel that way, but, you know, like any medical student, I sort of gave myself a fake deadline
mm-hmm.
that I could work towards that was earlier than the real deadline, so I wouldn't feel absolutely rushed at the end.
Like, sure.
You know, I knew that I had a buffer zone. I told myself it had to be due by June 1st, but it really wasn't due until July 1st. It was just one of those coping mechanisms you do to give yourself the sense of more pressure to get it done and yet not have it be the absolute deadline.
Absolutely.
But yeah, I did feel a little bit more pressure to write for the book because I, you know, was contractually obligated to have it, you know, have it done by a certain time. Whereas a blog, it's a little more free form. It's a little bit more immediate, you know, the feedback you get from it. It's just a fun medium, and I just think, you know, it's one of the future of medicine, and how do you communicate with your patients is an online presence.
And for people, we have to wrap things up, but before we go, Dr. Michelle Au, what is your website again?
My website is www.michelleau.com, M-I-C-H-E-L-L-E-A-U.
And, of course, that information will be on our website at www.answers4thefamily.com, blog.com. And we'll have her information along with ours. And thank you so much for being here today and talking with us, Michelle. I really thoroughly enjoyed your book. I can't wait for your next book, whenever that might be.
Thank you so much.
And it's a great joy and a lot of fun, and much success on the rest of your career.
Thanks so much for having me. It was really fun.
Thank you so much, and have a great day. And everybody else, on behalf of Alan Cardoza, myself, Dr. Melody Fox, we look forward to talking with you next week. Bye-bye for now.
You're listening to the home of cool, irreverent, and entertaining talk right here on LA Talk Radio.